Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another live stream edition of Liberty Lockdown. This is Clint Russell. I'm thrilled today to have on Larry Elder, former gubernatorial candidate, up against Satan himself, Gavin Newsom. I can see him in the backdrop laughing right now. Screw it. I'm not going to do any introductions. I'm too pumped to have Larry here. Let's just talk to him. How are you doing, Larry?
You know, Clint, Trump refers to him as new scums.
This is actually my first question for you. Do you think that Gavin Newsom realizes he sold his soul, or does he think he's a good guy?
No, he thinks he's a good guy. And I talk about that in my latest book called As Goes California. I find it amusing when people think that if Joe Biden can't make it to November, the Democrats are going to swap him out with Gavin Newsom. Mm-hmm. Everything you don't like about how the country is going because of the policies by Joe Biden, Gavin Newsom would throw gasoline on it. Yeah. Joe Biden, of course, is a climate change guy. He war on oil and gas, but he's never done what Gavin Newsom has done, which is to outlaw the sale of new gas-powered cars by the year 2035. Gavin Newsom has set up a commission for reparations. He signed a bill to raise the minimum wage to $20. That's a 25% increase. Imagine running a business with thin margins. All these fast food businesses run with thin margins, and suddenly your labor costs have gone up 25% by the stroke of a pen. 1 million people have left California in the last 3 years. And the number one reason, Clint, that people cite when they leave is they cannot afford the price of a home. The average price of a home is about twice that of the national average. Gavin Newsom served 2 terms as mayor of San Francisco, 2 terms as lieutenant governor, and this is his 2nd term now as governor. So his fingerprints are on all of this. It's just a joke that people think that somehow, some way, if you feel that the country's on the wrong track and 2/3 of Americans feel that way, Gavin Newsom is going to put it on the right track. It's a joke.
No, it's I would go so far as to say it's actually certifiably insane to think that guy can actually fix things. I completely agree with your assessment. You don't know me well enough to say, but I'm a refugee from San Diego, spent 35 years there, absolutely loved it. And I fled explicitly because of Gavin Newsom and the lockdown regime. It was absolutely excruciating.
He locked down the state, Clint, as you know, in a more severe way than did any other governor. 1/3 of all restaurants in California are now gone forever. And most of these are the thinly capitalized mom and pop restaurants run by black and brown people, the very people that people like Gavin Newsom purport to care about. Right. California has the highest unemployment rate in the nation. We have the lowest job creation rate in the nation in the last couple of years, all because of the tax spend regulate policies by people like Gavin Newsom. You can't blame it on Republicans. There hasn't been a Republican elected statewide in California in 20 years, and Democrats have 2/3 majority in the Senate, 2/3 majority in the Assembly. They have been running this place for decades, and that's why it's been running to the ground.
The proof is in the consequences. I mean, it is absolutely, it changed so dramatically. And I feel like people don't really understand that. Like they think maybe it's hyperbole, it's overstated. No, it is absolutely catastrophic and very dramatically. So I'm curious at this point, because obviously since I'm a refugee from California, I gave up on the state. I thought that it was hopeless at this point. Do you still have hope?
I get that question a lot, Clint. Why are you still here? You wrote a book about how bad California is and about how the California politicians attack businesses, but you're still there. I believe, Clint, call me naive, but the captain of the Titanic would have taken evasive action had he known iceberg ahead. I'm yelling iceberg ahead. And I think sooner or later, the common sense of most people will take hold. Look, crime is up. In part because of these soft on crime policies that people like Gavin Newsom have supported. We have a proposition called 57, which lowered a bunch of categories of crime from violent offenses to non-violent offense. I'm not making this up. Assault on a police officer is now a non-violent offense. Serial arson is now a non-violent offense. Rape of an intoxicated victim is now a non-violent offense. This is what's going on in California because of these soft on crime DAs, like the one in the Bay Area that was recalled and the one here named George Gascon that Gavin Newsom has supported. All these kinds of things are coming together, which is why so many people are leaving California. We have a massive homeless problem. I think about 1/3 of all the homeless people in America live in California. We have huge poverty, huge gap between the rich and the poor, highest state income tax in the nation. And when wealthy people like Elon Musk leave, and he did a few years ago, he's taking hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars in taxes over the course of next several years with him. We have a huge unfunded pension liability here in the state, $1.5 trillion, that's T as in Tyrannosaurus, owed to pensioners, present or future, and we don't have the money to pay for it. So it's a death spiral right now.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with your assessment. And interesting is that RFK Jr. picked Nicole Shanahan to be his VP. She is, from my understanding, a huge donor to Gascon's, you know, takeover and ultimately destruction of Los Angeles. And it's like, this is the outsider we're going with, RFK Jr.? Goodness gracious.
Which is why I've always thought it was a joke for Republicans and conservatives to support this guy. And when I campaigned for president, a lot of people told me they were taking a hard look at him. I said, why? Okay, he was right about the vaccines. And he said some commonsensical kinds of things about whether or not we should have a completely open border, but we're not scrutinizing who's coming in. Outside of that, he's still a tax, spend, regulate, socialized medicine, healthcare, a Democrat. And this choice for VP confirms that. So I hope now some of the people who were thinking about voting for him instead of somebody like Donald Trump will now rethink it because of the choice for his VP.
Well, this begs the question because, you know, I'm a libertarian. But I'm certainly, I don't have Trump derangement syndrome by any stretch of the imagination. And I think that he would be a far better option than Biden. But I am very concerned about what transpired during 2020. And I still have yet to see a real about face from him over that year. You know, it's like I've said many times, I think the first 3 years of his presidency were probably the best in my lifetime. And the last one was probably the worst. And I don't know how you balance that out and you make a calculation as to whether or not he deserves a second go at it. But I'm curious, do you think that he has realized what transpired in that era?
Well, Clint, I know you're a libertarian and I am a small L libertarian. I call myself a Republican, a la Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman was a registered Republican, but he also called himself a small L libertarian. And that's where I am. I think Donald Trump was initially, he was dismissive about the COVID, the pandemic. He thought that eventually it was going to go away. And he started getting hammered in the polls. Democrats accused him of not caring. And I think he panicked and then went the wrong way and did this warp speed thing and essentially told people they should take this vaccine. He was unproven, untested. I think a lot of people now realize it. The lockdowns were a huge, huge mistake, probably the biggest healthcare mistake ever made. I'm sure he regrets it. I guess I give him a bit of a mulligan because I think he was so pressured by the media, by members of his own party to do something to at least show some kind of concern because initially he was dismissive because he felt it was basically a trumped up kind of thing so that you'd have something to attack him on. That was his reaction. So it was a Trumpian kind of reaction. He overreacted, and I think he knows that now.
Okay. Well, I had a one or two-on-one conversation for about an hour with his son, Donald Trump Jr. And I am convinced that he knows what time it is. I don't know Trump himself. So it's, I hope that that's reflected in his father.
What did he say, Clint, about what his father did to combat COVID and about warp speed? What was his defense?
Yeah. I mean, he similar to what you said and, you know, more than that, really what I wanted to hear from him, and it was off the record, so I can't give details, but I just wanted to know if they understand how dire the circumstances are. You know, like his father is facing 700 years in prison and he still goes around and he puts on a good, you know, happy face and he seems relatively jovial and he takes everything in stride. And at some point we need someone who's not going to take things in stride, someone who's actually going to say like, look, our judicial system has been weaponized against political opposition. And that once you hit that inflection point, it's really no turning back time. I mean, you're banana republic after that. Right. And it's just like, we need a hero. We don't need someone who's going to try and get in there and save face. We need someone who's going to be really courageous and be willing to risk everything. And if he perceives the threats that I do, that means that you're really going to have to put your life on the line. Like you're up against really dangerous forces. And I just want to know that he understands that and he's prepared for it.
Oh, I think he understands it. And I think if anybody's prepared for it, it's this man. I had about a 40-minute private conversation with him. Clinton, I brought up the same kinds of things. And I ask him whether or not he ever gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning and says, why the bleep did I do this? And he talked about the two-tier dust system and about he privately, he's very funny, drops the F word here and there, and said, I've been indicted more times than effing Al Capone. And I haven't killed anybody. And he's very angry about the two-tier judicial system. He's
good.
Aware of it. So I'm not too worried about that part. But I do feel that he panicked regarding COVID, put this vaccine down our throats, untested, unproven, and essentially supported lockdowns or encouraged them. So it was a mistake, but virtually everybody made that mistake. And also the complicity of social media, shutting down people that raised questions about the lockdowns. All of that happened, and a lot of that was sort of out of Donald Trump's control. So,
yeah, no, it was. It's just, I would like to, you know, he says, I am your vengeance. And I'm like, I want to know what that entails. I want to know, who are you going to put in as your AG? Are we actually going to see a genuine investigation and prosecution for the origin, for Fauci's role in all of this, EcoHealth? Like these are really important questions. And I feel like the only reason that RFK Jr. has any, you know, even fraction of a chance of an outsider's chance of getting into this race in a serious way is because this is Trump's weak spot. And I feel like he can close that off by just saying, look, I was buffaloed. I turned to the technocrats. I turned to the medical health establishment, and they absolutely lied through their teeth. I'm not going to fall for that again. In fact, I'm going to make sure that we punish the people responsible for the greatest infringement on liberty in your lifetime and mine. And I'm going to make sure this never happens again. He says that RFK Jr.'s campaign is over, as far as I'm concerned.
I think Trump will say something like that. I'm not sure he'll say it as well as you just now did, but I know that he knows he made a mistake. I know that he knows he overreacted. The question is, Donald Trump never, ever, ever says I'm sorry, ever. Yes. I think one or two times he might have said that after the Hollywood Access tape came out, and then he apologized for some of his language. Outside of that, the man does not apologize. His way of apologizing is not to say the same stupid thing twice. I had a conversation with him in 2016 when he was running. And I said, you know, there is one thing you should apologize for. He said, I know what you're going to say, what I said about John McCain. I said, no, not at all. I said, you said that regarding the Iraq war, that George W. Bush lied about it. Now, you can say what you want to say about the Iraq war. I know that most libertarians opposed it. But the idea that George W. Bush lied is a lie. He did not lie. He had bad information. And I went over all of that with him. I told him that the resolution that Congress passed didn't just talk about WMD. It talked about the fact that Saddam Hussein had tried to assassinate the first George Herbert Walker Bush, about the stealing from the oil for food program, about shooting at the British and American planes patrolling the southern and no-fly zones. And we know that he had WMD because he used them on the Kurds, he used them on the Iranians. I said all of that was in the resolution. So when you say Donald Trump, George W. Bush lied us into the war, you're giving that Ted Kennedy talking point. You ought not say it anymore. Now, he's not said it again since then, and I'm going to take credit.
Well, you and I do part ways on that topic, but it's okay. I do actually want to ask you about foreign policy, though.
We only part ways on whether or not we should have done it. We don't part ways on the notion that George W. Bush lied about it. I mean, I talked to Condi Rice and Colin Powell both publicly and privately, and they both rued the intel that said Saddam Hussein had stockpiles of WMD, but they both told me that nobody lied. We just screwed it up. We just got it
okay.
Wrong.
Well, I'll take your and their word for it, but I find it very hard to believe that the yellow cake uranium stuff. If Powell was actually buffaloed, then I retract it. But someone was responsible for delivering that intel that was faulty, and as a consequence, hundreds of thousands of innocent people perished. And I think that there was no consequences that were paid. And this is kind of similar to the lockdown era. It's like so many people's lives were lost during this period, if not even because of, you know, COVID and all that stuff, but just because of despair and suicide and drug addiction and all this stuff. And there's no consequences paid. And I feel like my entire life there has just been really severe, I'll be kind and say, missteps by our federal government, and the people have paid the price, but the political elite don't. I just feel is like, if that doesn't change, if that paradigm doesn't change, then really nothing improves.
Well, regarding the Iraq war, and I don't want to spend too much more time on it, but there were WMD. They found all sorts of stuff after Saddam Hussein was deposed. Frankly, I don't think the intel was bad. The other thing is this: we don't know what kind of world there would have been had Saddam Hussein remained in power. George W. Bush sent in two people. They were called weapons hunters. David Kaye was one of them, and a guy named Charlie Dulfer. And they both said that as soon as the heat was off, Saddam Hussein intended to go back to developing WMD. So I'm not quite sure what kind of war we would have had had we remained in power. I don't know that, and you don't know that. All we can do is give our best guess, which is what the president's paid to do. You have a bunch of competing kinds of choices to make. Many of the options are bad, and you have to kind of do what you think is the best judgment. So,
yeah. Well, no, it's true, of course. But I think that, you know, my big concern, just to bring the geopolitical topic into more modern times, is that, you know, for instance, Joe Biden bragged pretty egregiously that we will bring the Nord Stream pipeline to an end. And in a rare moment from an inquisitive reporter says, how? He says, we will. We have ways. And it was, and yet there is no, once again, there's no investigation, there's no inquiry, there's no congressional hearings, there's no outrage, there's no media follow-up. And this is, I mean, from most estimates, this is the largest act of ecological terrorism. I'm not some big greenie, but still, given that Biden, you know, pretends to be, that should be counter to his belief system. Right. And it also is, as far as I'm concerned, an act of war against Germany, a NATO partner. It's bizarre that has gone under the radar. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
Well, there's so much misinformation out there. I'm not sure who to believe. I'm not sure who to trust. We've been lied to so many different times. And everybody, all these parties involved have an incentive to lie and spin things their way. So I don't really know I don't know that we're ever going to find out exactly what happened.
Yeah. Well, there was an investigation. I think it was Denmark. And they said they're not, you know, they know it's not as reported, but they're not going to point any fingers. And then you had an insurance company come out yesterday and say that they're not going to pay out on the insurance claim because they believe that it was a government actor. Again, not pointing any fingers. You know, Putin has said that it was either the British or the U.S. He just kind of combined them into one blob. And I don't know what the truth is. My concern is that we're risking World War III trying to defend the borders of Ukraine while our borders remain wide open. I don't understand the geopolitical gain in this. It just seems as if the military-industrial complex is getting fed to the detriment of not just our soldiers, but our people and our financial condition. We're $35 trillion in debt, $1 trillion in interest alone over the next 12 months is going to be the largest expenditure from the federal government. This is really serious stuff, and it's not being talked about with the level of grave seriousness that I remember as a very young boy when it came to you know, the Cold War. What's your opinion as to how serious this threat is between Russia?
I think it's very serious. I think that it's not hyperbole to say that we might be on the brink of World War III. But I also feel that that's because of this commander in chief. He pulled out of Afghanistan, didn't inform our allies, and then threw the military under the bus by claiming falsely that nobody told him that if you pull out, the Taliban would return and the Afghan government would collapse. Two high-ranking generals testified under oath that that's exactly what they told Joe Biden, and he didn't listen. So if I'm an ally or a friend, either the military is incompetent, ally or foe, either the military is incompetent or the commander-in-chief refused to follow their advice. Either way, not good. 13 right. service members died. We left $7 or $8 billion worth of military equipment there. I mean, honestly, and that, in my opinion, is what motivated Hamas, what motivated Putin, and what is motivating China. They feel that George Bush. They feel that Joe Biden is weak and feckless and pretty useless as a commander in chief. I think the world would be very different if Donald Trump had been reelected.
Yeah, well, I don't necessarily disagree with that. And all you have to do is watch Biden give a speech and you're like, yeah, he looks pretty weak and feckless to me.
Let me give you another quick example, Clint. I'm in the airport. This is during the campaign of 2020 when Trump's running for reelection. And I start talking to a military chaplain whose son is in special ops. And he said, I did not vote for Donald Trump in 2016. I thought he was crude. I thought he was vulgar. I didn't like his private life.
But all the now things I liked about him.
but now I'm going to vote for him. I said, why? He said, my son is in special ops. I can't tell you what he's doing. But my son feels protected because our enemies are scared bleepless. He said, that's reason enough for me to vote for him this time. So that's how I think our enemies feared us. And you heard the expression before. And our friends respected us. Now, the opposite is the case under this under this commander-in-chief. He's given mixed signals about what he's going to do about Ukraine, mixed signals about what he's going to do about the Hamas-Israel war. I don't know what day it is and what he's going to say or do next. I really don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure he knows either. So whoever writes his scripts in the morning. Look, I, you know, you had a very viral moment in the past couple months when you went on the Breakfast Club up against Charlamagne the God, and I really appreciated your candor. I think that it's a topic that honestly I don't cover very often because it's just kind of outside of my purview as a libertarian. I don't really focus on that stuff, but I think it's really important, and I think that there has been, well, first off, what has been the fallout post that interview?
Well, it wasn't just Charlamagne the God versus Elder. It was three against one. He had two co-hosts.
Yeah.
So therefore it was a fair fight.
Yeah. and you dominated all three. It was amazing.
About 1.2 million people have watched that interview so far. And if you look at his recent interviews, he averages about 50,000 people per show. So a huge number of people watched it. I didn't read all the comments, Clint, but there were 60,000 last I checked. And one of my friends read every single one of them. And 85% of them were pro-Elder, and these are his people. And they were talking about how ill-informed he was. And the reason this topic is important, the topic that whether or not America remains systemically racist, is because the Democrats and the media have convinced Black people that it is. And as a result, Democrats have gotten about 90% or so of the Black vote. And it is a lie. It's not just a lie. It's a lie of getting people killed.
Today's episode of Liberty Lockdown is once again brought to you by the savagest motherfuckers on the planet, Phoenix Ammunition. Go to phoenixammo.com anytime you're running low. The only place to go is Phoenix Ammo. Seriously, the greatest company in the universe. I'm not overstating it. I absolutely fucking love these guys. They are totally savage. If you go on Twitter, aka X, and you look up at Phoenix Ammo, they are hysterical. They are totally the real deal. They are totally savage, as I said to start this off. And they do not hold back. They don't really give a fuck about anything other than freedom. And that's exactly why I wanted them to be a partner on this show. I don't get any kickbacks from this. There is no promo code because they already give you a discount when you buy in bulk. So you don't need to even let them know that I sent you. Just go anytime you're running low to phoenixammo.com.
George Floyd died because of the maneuver that Derek Chauvin put on him, there were 4 months of protests in America, the largest protests, the most serious ones in the history of this country. 25 people died. 2,000 police officers were wounded. It was $2 billion worth of insured damage, probably another billion or two in uninsured damage, all because of an assumption that what happened to George Floyd had to do with his race. When, in fact, the lead prosecutor was a Black man, the trial was televised, and he took pains to say the police in general are not on trial. The Minneapolis PD in general is not on trial. This individual was on trial for what this individual did or didn't do. He never even implied that Derek Chauvin was motivated by George Floyd's race, and Chauvin was never charged with a hate crime. Yet if you look at all these people out there and you interview them, they were on the streets because of a belief that the American, that our police system is systemically racist, and George Floyd was Exhibit A. And what it's done, it's called the Ferguson effect or the George Floyd effect. That's the phenomenon of cops pulling back from doing their normal proactive policing. So all around the country, in places like LA, Chicago, New York, crime is up. But you know what's down? Arrests, because the officers are simply not doing what they used to do because of this lie. And the people who are hurt the most are the very Black and brown people that people like Black Lives Matter purport to care about. Every year, the police kill more whites than they kill Blacks. They kill more unarmed whites than they kill Blacks. I bet most people could not name an unarmed white person because nobody gives a damn when it's an unarmed white person, unarmed Black person. In comes CNN. In comes Van Jones. In comes a comment by Joe Biden. Speaking of which, he gave a speech at Howard University some months back, and he said the number one threat to the homeland was white supremacy. And almost on cue, 3 or 4 weeks later, a white racist, self-described white racist, murdered three people in Jacksonville, Florida, and Joe Biden made a statement. About 2 months earlier, however, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a Black man got a gun, went up to a white guy he didn't know, shot him in the back of the head, killed him, went to another white guy he doesn't know, shot him in the back of the head and killed him, and admitted he did it because they were white. And Joe Biden didn't say a damn thing. And here's the point. Most homicides in this country are same-race homicides. Most Blacks who are killed are killed by other Blacks. Most whites who are killed are killed by other whites. However, every year there are roughly 750 interracial Black-white homicides. 500 white people killed by Blacks, even though Blacks are just 13% of the population. 250 Blacks killed by whites, even though whites are 60% of the population. And that's just murder. Let's talk about violent non-homicides. There are roughly 800,000, probably 600,000 instances every single year by non-homicide violent crime. I'm talking about
assault and battery,
manslaughter, attempted murder, rape, assault with a weapon. 600,000 interracial black-white actions every year. 85% of the time, it is a black perp and white victim, only 15% the other way around. Yet Joe Biden gives a speech and says the number one threat to the homeland is white supremacy, and people buy it. That's why everybody ought to be concerned about this lie, even though it's not something that you cover very much on your show. If people believe that, they're going to act accordingly, and it's going to be to the detriment of the country.
Yeah, well said. And you know, I can name a white victim of police violence. His name's Daniel Shaver, and it was one of the most egregious I've ever seen in my entire life. And you know, as a libertarian, I'm very skeptical of police power, you know, monopoly on violence, all that stuff. But I also think that as long as the police are going to exist and not be privatized, it's very important that we be honest about what's going on, and we don't overstate or exaggerate the conditions. My vantage point is this: as someone who grew up in the 90s, our race relations were far better than they are today, and I feel like this consistent focus on race and what, you know, our differences, if you even believe that it's much of a difference. But the more we focus on it and the more we harp on it, I feel like race relations are deteriorating. And it's my assumption, or it's my belief, that this is, in fact, an intentional divide and conquer tactic. And I'm curious if you feel similarly.
I sure do. Clint, I was in Boston 2004 when this skinny little guy with funny ears and a funny name named Barack Obama came out and gave the introduction speech to John Kerry, the Democrat nominee that year. There's no blue America. There's no red America. There's just one America. Everybody went nuts. There's no black America. There's no white America. There's just one America. The United States, everybody went nuts. And I turned to my producer. I said, this guy's going to run for president someday, and he'll probably get elected. Fast forward, he ran. And when he was running, he was interviewed by 60 Minutes. And the correspondent said, Senator, if you don't win, will it be because of racism? And I said to myself, let's see how this man answers this question. Is he going to give what I call a victocrat answer, a la Al Sharpton when Sharpton ran and blamed his failure on racism, or Jesse Jackson ran twice and blamed his failure on racism? Senator said, no. If I don't win, it will be because I have not articulated a vision that the American people can embrace. I said, hallelujah. He's giving a speech at a black church, this is when he was running, and he said about how much racism there remained in America. The Moses generation, referring to the generation of Martin Luther King, has gotten us 90% of the way there. My generation, he called it the Joshua generation, has to get us an additional 10%, which I thought was reasonable. That's the man America thought they hired. The one they did hire was the guy who for 8 years played one race card after another, after another, after another. From the Cambridge police acted stupidly, to if I had a son, he looked like Trayvon, to embracing Black Lives Matter, having Al Sharpton at the White House over 70 times, to mentioning Ferguson at a speech for the United Nations, and Michael Brown did not have his hands up, did not say don't shoot. The whole thing was a big fat lie. And when he entered the Oval Office, he had a 70% approval rating. Think about that, Clint. Only 52% voted for him. 70% approval rating. He hadn't signed a bill, hadn't done anything. Yet when he walked into the Oval Office the third week of January 2009, 70% approval. Why? Because people who did not vote for him said, at the very least, he'll bring us together racially. He'll put a fork to the notion that America remains systemically racist. When he left, when he entered, both blacks and whites polls thought race relations would improve. When he left, both blacks and whites thought they got worse. All because of the way he played the race card over and over again. And he did it for exactly the reason that you mentioned, for power. As long as you get black people angry and thinking about social justice, not about crime, not about schools, not about jobs, they'll go in there like lemmings and pull that lever for the Democratic Party, which is what they've been doing for decades.
Yeah, man. Well said. And I feel as if, you know, what I'm witnessing on the internet with this rise of anti-Semitism is kind of, once again, it, like the same mechanism that you're saying Obama used against the black community. I feel like there is a grievance politics that's being pushed amongst, exactly, you know, white people. And I don't think that it's healthy. I don't think it brings us together. I don't think it brings us forward. And just one more bullet point on Obama's, you know, divide and conquer tactics. He was also responsible for an executive order, August 2011, that mandated diversity, equity, inclusion hiring practices in every federal department across the entire government. And it gets no conversation. Donald Trump, to his credit, repealed it in the last month of his presidency, and day one of Biden's presidency, he put that back into place. So, you know, this is a very on high operation that's being ran. I believe it's coming from the CIA. I'll let you, you don't have to agree on that one, but.
It's a cancer. It's the whole Marxist philosophy, which is that the oppressors are oppressing the oppressed. That's how people view things. And that's how young people have been taught to view things. And it's a cancer. This DEI stuff is a cancer. It's an attack on merit. It's an attack on what MLK wanted, which was a colorblind society, not a color coordinated society. And it's dangerous. It's pitting people against other people.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I hope that, you know, voices like yours are able to wake people up and stop this decline. We need to not be focusing on what makes us different all the time. And from my vantage point, what I think brings us together more than anything is focusing on merit and our actual beliefs, because regardless of our color, we can still share beliefs. And it's like these are things that bring us together. And also, you know, seeing some athlete or some actor or someone who's like really, really gifted at their craft, not because they were put in there for some DEI purpose, but because they're just unbelievably talented. That's the type of thing that drops the racial divide and starts to make us, appreciate one another more. And I felt like we were going there, and I feel like we're going far, far away from it. So I hope that process stops here soon.
And I'll tell you another reason we're going far away from it. There is an epidemic of fatherlessness in America. 70% of Black kids today enter the world without a father in the home married to the mother. 50% of Hispanic kids do. 25% of white kids do, which was the same percentage of Black kids who entered the world without a father in the home married to the mother back in 1965. In 1965, a Democrat named Lyndon Johnson launched the so-called War on Poverty. And since then, we've spent about $20 trillion allegedly fighting poverty while poverty has flatlined. What we've done, however, is incentivize women to marry the government and incentivize men to abandon their financial and moral responsibility. When you're raised without a father in the home, you're 5 times more likely to be poor and commit crime, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, and 20 times more likely to end up in jail. And nobody, Clint, is talking about it. If you're on the right, you talk about it. If you're white, you'll be accused of engaging in systemic racism or somehow dissing single moms that are raising these boys and girls by themselves. And if you're Black, you'll be called, as I was called by the LA Times, the black face of white supremacy. So nobody's talking about the number one domestic issue in America, which is the breakdown of the nuclear intact family.
Yeah. Well, I completely agree. I mean, I think that our issues are cultural largely, and certainly there's a knock-on effect or a trickle-down effect that comes from the government and government policies, the LBJ and even FDR, going all the way back to FDR. But it needs to stop, and we need to, I think more and more we need to stop looking to the federal government to remedy this and start to look to the communities, look to the churches, look to, local leaders to try and remedy what ails and hopefully, I mean, you just look at the population, not implosion, but we've certainly flatlined in America, and you are starting to see it decline the world over. I'll end with this. Do you think that biological? Is it an evolutionary thing that we're reproducing less? Is it a byproduct of technology that's making us less functional? Is it getting away from God? Like, what do you think it is that's making us have less kids?
I think the more affluent a society becomes, often the less children people are willing to have. I think it's also probably cyclical. I really don't know. I don't have any kids. I never wanted them. My parents obviously did, otherwise you and I wouldn't be talking. And I have two brothers, and they both had big families. I'm the only one in my family that never had kids because I never really wanted kids. I got married a long time ago for a brief time, but I've been single all but 2 years of my life, and I'll be 72 in about a week. So
you're 70? What?
Come on,
dude, Clint, you're 50. Don't lie to me.
Black don't crack. Clint, the elder the berry, the sweeter the juice.
The CIA delivers the crack, but the black don't crack.
That's right. And one more quick thing something you brought up about FDR and the New Deal. You learn in your textbooks that FDR came in on a white horse and passed the New Deal and rescued us from the Great Depression. When in fact, what he did was take a recession and make it worse and turn it into a depression by all the spending that he did. There is an economist named Leo Hanian out here at UCLA. He's probably done more work on the impact of the New Deal than any other economist in the country. And he said that the New Deal deepened and lengthened what otherwise would have been a recession that we were already coming out of until FDR did all the things that he did. That lesson is the same lesson that Democrats follow and believe that they ought to do whenever there's a recession. They spend more, they do this, and they make things worse. And it's a lesson that they need to learn, but they don't learn it. Minimum wage out here in California, they just jack it up to $20 an hour. I was having dinner once with Thomas Sowell, one of my friends and mentors, and he's done a lot of work on the minimum wage. In fact, the minimum wage is what caused him to stop being a Marxist. You know, he used to be a Marxist, and he worked for the Department of Labor, and he did a study for them when he was in school, and he found out that the minimum wage hurt people at the very bottom, the very black and brown, unskilled people that people thought the minimum wage would help. And when he went back to show the report, he was informed by the Labor Department management, oh, we don't care about that. Our job is simply to administer the law. We don't really care about the effect. And I asked him, how is it that even Republicans like Dr. Ben Carson supported a higher minimum wage? I think Rick Santorum even did once. How is it that even Republicans don't understand this? He said, because they don't know it. They don't know the studies. They haven't heard the studies. They haven't heard the research. And that's overwhelmingly scary. Economists say that the minimum wage hurts the very people that people who push it expect. There's even an editorial in the New York Times, 1987, headline, the ideal minimum wage, 0.00. They since have done a 180, but the principles of Econ 101 have not done a 180. The politics have done a 180. It's hurting the very people that people who push this stuff claim that they care about.
Yeah, well, going back to why I know about the FDR as well as I do, I'll quote Moicano from the UFC this past weekend. Read your fucking Ludwig von Mises, and then you'd understand.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or Thomas Sowell, for that matter. Either will get you there.
Or Hayek, Road to Serfdom.
Exactly. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Larry. This has been a fantastic conversation. Go ahead and tell my audience where they can follow and support your work.
We haven't talked about Old Glory Bank, the bank that I'm involved in.
Well, let's do that.
Real quickly. It's a bank that I co-founded along with the aforementioned Dr. Ben Carson, John Rich, country western singer, and a Oklahoma former governor named Mary Fallon, all because banks like Bank of America have been debanking people based upon their beliefs, based upon whether or not they are involved in the NRA. And Bank of America, even without a court order, Clint, turned over records of people who were in Washington, D.C., who were their customers, who entered a Dick's Sporting Goods store a few days after January 6th. Why? Because they may have bought a weapon. And they turned over their records without even a court order. And Donald Trump Jr. was giving a town hall, I think it was in Missouri, and PayPal wouldn't process the tickets because they didn't like his politics. We have Old Glory Pay, so that doesn't happen. Everything that you do with your bank, you can do with Old Glory. Just go to oldglorybank.com. And by the way, if you open up an account, when you get your debit card in the mail, you will get a free copy of Larry Elder's book, As Goes California. So go to oldglorybank.com, open an account, and we will not debank you if you're a law-abiding. Our mission is the Constitution.
I love it, man. And that's a huge, huge market need. So I wish you guys immense success with it. Larry, continued success in the future, and please continue to go into the lion's den and speak the truth. It's incredibly valuable. And I hope you know that you're appreciated.
Can I mention my little show? I have a show called We've Got a Country to Save.
Yeah.
It's pinned at the top of my Twitter account.
I was told you only had 30 minutes. So yeah, I'll go as long as you want, really.
I speak quickly. And you can get it anywhere you get your podcast. It's also on YouTube under Larry Elder, We've Got a Country to Save. So awesome. I'm still very active in all these kinds of things. I also just started a PAC called MakeAmericaJustAgain.org to get rid of these soft on crime, George Soros-backed DAs that are not enforcing the law. And they're all over the place. And I'm talking about some of these soft on crime policies like cashless bail, where people, in my opinion, who are career criminals are not behind bars, but out in the streets, hurting the very black and brown people living in the inner city that people on the left who push these soft on crime policies and these soft on crime George Soros-backed DAs think they're helping. So the website is MakeAmericaJustAgain.org. That's MakeAmericaJustAgain.org. And I'll stop selling.
No, keep selling, brother. It's okay. Man, I cannot believe you're 72 or almost 72 years old. That I'm genuinely shocked. This is not like performative shock.
I appreciate that. I get reverse carded. I was in Key West having a drink, and I mentioned a song that I liked when I was a teenager. He said, "How old are you?" And I told him, he goes, "I don't believe that." I whipped out my driver's license, had to show him.
You're like,
how do you get reverse carded?
You're like, I loved when Elvis first came out when I was in high school, and you're like, what? How is that possible? Anyways, thank you again, Larry. If anybody wants to support my work, you can subscribe at Liberty Lock Pod on X, libertylockdown.locals.com. Make sure you hit the like button, hit the subscription, leave a comment, share it with your friends and family, and most importantly, hug and kiss your mom and thank her for making sure you could be here. See you soon.
God bless.
Welcome to Liberty Lockdown. Please scan your barcode. Your liberty ain't gone, but yeah, it's on hold. Where did it come from and where did it go?